Thank you very much. Thank you, Joan, so much for inviting me. Thank you, Jimmy, for hosting Hemingway's. And thank you so much to Jessica and Barrett for coming out from Baltimore, coming back to Pittsburgh. I'm going to read one poem from my new chapbook. My new chapbook is called The Paul Simon Project. It's only $5. And every poem is after a Paul Simon title. So this one is called My Little Town. I'm totally blind lately. On top of mine. My Little Town. I grew up believing. Heather in the lunchroom who mocked my attire from head to toe. Stephen who stood king of the hill and swore, I'll milk you, girl. Kurt in combat fatigues who promised to slice the cheese between my legs with a ninja sword. Jason who soaked my pale new dress with a mud puddle and a souped-up hot rod. In my little town, kittens were vulnerable and wombs were fertile. Good girls got good grades. Spring smelled like forsythia. Blondes were beautiful and nights dark and quiet. Fathers commuted to the DOD while mothers gossiped in their tennis whites. Flying my bike past the parking lot of the 7-Eleven, past the midnight rednecks with their pickups and six-packs, held in the safety of my brother's black jacket, pedaling furiously to a rendezvous with the last Catholic boy this side of Maryland, making out hard on the asphalt edge of a new housing development, falling head over heels at breakneck speed, shedding red bandana so hair tumbles free, holding on tightly to straight A's in virginity, double-edged, sure-shot, one-way ticket out of my little town. And I'm going to read a short story that was in Free State Review number 2. Short story is also set in Virginia. It's an outtake of my novel, The Second Elizabeth. It's set at the same deli. Jesse at the delicatessen. Jesse was never going to last long at the deli. He was too tall, too smart, and too motor-mouthed. If he'd talked less or chopped coarser, maybe I wouldn't have noticed that he was going to get bored making sandwiches for law school students within weeks. If he'd been shorter like Sean, maybe we wouldn't have thought he was too old for a job that paid $5.50 an hour. If he'd told fewer jokes, maybe we would have been slower to see how unhinged he was when he arrived at the Blue Ridge Delicatessen. Jesse talked a lot about the breakup. He was funny enough to get away with a heavy load of bitterness, and he was bitter enough to be hilarious. He'd start conversations with phrases like, I believe it was Robert Plant who said, soul of a woman was created below. He told me it meant women were harpies from hell. He'd say shit like this to us all the time, totally straight-faced. Sean, who was eternally stoned anyway, had a continuous chuckle going around Jesse. Krista was always erupting into short bursts of disbelieving laughter in a Midwestern accent. Renee on the cash register frowned conspicuously, like if she didn't, God might mistake her for the sinner. And when the bosses walked through, Jesse tried to pass for an eager employee, although he fucked it up pretty regularly. He just never got the tone right. Randy would roll his eyes and turn up his collar. Frank just ignored Jesse's monologues while he found something else to correct us about. Too much cheese on the Dagwood or not enough coleslaw for the post-game rush. That woman would bawl your neighbor's sheepdog while you went to the corner store for ring-dings. That was the kind of thing Jesse liked to blurt out if the bosses weren't around. One afternoon, I was taking out a load of trash when Jesse drove into the parking lot. He greeted me with a typical one-off, part smart-ass pickup line, part misogynist joke. That was when I found out that he owned what I called the Escape to Witch Mountain van. I had noticed it parked out there before, but I thought it belonged to one of the bar regulars, maybe the guy who always orders his tuna melt and didn't complain when I baked a strand of my hair into it. You know the kind, one of those compact campers that hangs over a pickup truck. His had a screen door on the side, like it opened into a tiny house. I never even saw the movie, but it was a scenario that got into my childhood dreams anyway. A live-action Disney production about telepathic twins who storm around the American West, trying to dodge diabolical millionaires who want to harness their powers and bomb blast the rest of the citizens. Sean was the one who told me Jesse had been sleeping in the van ever since. "She changed the locks and kept the dogs," said Sean, who had two wide-eyed toddlers and a live-in girlfriend he refused to marry. It sounded like the type of sing-songy thing Sean liked to say in his Central Virginia drawl, but it also sounded like it could be true. Sean's mouth was full of things that may or may not be true. Stories about the whole bar snorting lines off the cutting board after closing, the alien sightings that fueled his psychedelic paintings, the things his girlfriend said last night. All the evidence suggested that Jesse was pretty sharp, like how quickly he could make a punchline out of anything Randy said, or how he could tell if I was worried about my brother. But sometimes I thought of Jesse as an idiot, like when he would mash on the rich girls in front of their boyfriends. He had this whole routine around it. He'd make the dude come to the counter to get his corned beef, and then he'd walk the girl's pita sandwich and Diet Coke out to the table and talk her up. Renee was really bothered by it. I don't mean it offended her, but it made her nervous. Town and gown was one thing, but the blue bloods were another level entirely. You could smell the old money on them, touches of pedigree, even when they lacked manners. They could buy and sell that boy with one phone call, Renee said under her breath while she was wiping down the deli case. It reminded me of the night of the drug bust a few years ago. The FBI found contraband in every fraternity house, but calls were made, toilets were flushed. All the senator's sons got off scot-free, and only a few middle-class kids with shitty lawyers got strung up on charges for hippie drugs, pot, mushrooms, LSD. Poor Jimmy from Norfolk was serving 4 years in federal prison for over a $5 hit of acid. Well, anyway, that was the drug bust that got talked about. Then there were the weekly raids on Cherry Avenue. Marcus next door at the Chicken called it the President's War on Thugs. When I think about it, I never figured out too much about Jesse, where he came from or where he was going. He had no accent, Virginia or otherwise. He had no style that would suggest a thing he was or had once been. A prep schooler, a farmer, a soccer player, a deer hunter. His clothes didn't even seem to fit him, like he'd bought them at a Salvation Army on short notice or borrowed them from a friend who wasn't his size. For that matter, no friends came to visit him at the deli, and I wondered if he had lived around town with his missus or had just blown in recently for someplace different to go. Probably he was a guy who had worked in a lot of restaurants. I'm not sure the university knew it, but this train stop acted like a real city for a good number of people who were drawn here, from the mountains, from the cul-de-sacs, from the military enclaves, from the more conservative hamlets, those lonely villes and burgs. Here looked like an oasis in the middle of all that, a place to mingle, to try new things, to make a life as the person you chose to be, not the person they said you were. The time I ran into Jesse on Main Street, he startled me. I mean, I was walking down the street on my way home from the radio station, and he was driving around the corner near the hospital in the Escape to Witch Mountain van. "Don't turn your back on me, baby," he yelled out the window. I managed a, "What's up?" Once I sussed out which direction the voice was coming from. Cars were starting to beep at Jesse, who was crawling through rush hour traffic to keep talking to me like we were still standing over metal bins of sliced salami and tomatoes. I waved him off. I'll see you tomorrow, I told him. But Jesse quit showing up for his shifts, and we had to call in Krista, who was usually just lunches. I always said he was never long for the delicatessen, and Frank and Randy figured the same thing, but for different reasons. They thought he was a first-rate loser, good luck, good riddance, while the others started coming up with theories. Travis from the bar said he saw Jesse talking to that woman trucker, Larissa, for a long time the night before. At the corner table, by the pinball machine, Travis pointed, as if that made the difference. Sean said, what do you think, they're riding a white tiger through a rose-colored sunset on the Blue Ridge Parkway? And then he laughed to himself all the way back to the walk-in. Renee got it in her head that one of the rich boys had finally made that phone call. I think it spooked Sean at least a little, because soon after she said it, he dialed a bunch of other restaurants in town to see if they'd just hired a new dishwasher or prep cook. Then he took Squirrel with him and drove all around to see if they could spot the van, but nothing. Larissa came back with no more news than anyone else had and couldn't understand all the fuss. The guy lives on wheels. Where's the big mystery? She wanted to know. They gave Krista a 40-hour schedule after that. She started to work most of the closing shifts with me. We'd walk to the deli along the train tracks, and at night we'd walk home the safer way, down the avenue and around the blind curve. By 11:30, we were always tired and smelled like bleach and barbecue sauce, but she said the money couldn't have come at a better time. Thank you so much.